Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Thor Reide, a lecturer in cultural history at Utrecht University, to talk about his new book, The Works and Times of Johan Huizinga, Writing History in the Age of Collapse, out in 2023 with Amsterdam University Press. Good morning, Thor, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Jana.
How are you on this gray Amsterdam-y day?
Yeah, the weather is weighing heavy on me, but well, we'll survive.
It has been a very, very long, dreary spring.
Yeah, but only a few days ago, suddenly I smelled spring. It disappeared, but it'll come back.
It'll come back. Yeah, we were all outside just staring at the sun. Yeah, which is a Dutch trait I learned about when I moved here, just staring
at the sun. As soon as the sun pops out, that's what we do.
Yeah. All right. So let's jump into this book. So this was your doctoral research, yeah?
Yeah. It's a reworked version of what I did for my PhD. Yeah, that's right.
Which is quite recent. Yeah.
Yeah. No, soon 2 years ago that I obtained my doctoral degree. And since then, I've been reworking the manuscript. And now this book came out.
Yeah. That's actually really good turnaround time. And congratulations on the PhD.
Thank you.
All right. I can imagine so many reasons you'd be fascinated with Johan Huizinga. Yeah, I mean, he's one of the greats in our field, perhaps the greatest Dutch historian of ever. You shared his stomping grounds in Leiden. But how did this happen? How did you come to work on him?
Yeah, well, this was all quite unexpected. Even when I started my PhD, I had planned an entirely different research program. I was going to work on Kantian philosophy of history, early 19th century, late 18th century. But then quite soon I found myself to be interested more in the early 20th century historians writing about Kant than I was interested in Kant and his peers themselves. And that's sort of how Huizinga slipped onto my desk. And I think I was a year into my PhD research when I sort of decided that I might have to shift my focus. But originally, I was planning to work on the late Enlightenment.
Well, yeah, this happens, right? You don't know what's going to grab you, what's going to be your great love.
Yeah, no, exactly. And yeah, it's exciting to follow the enthusiasm and, of course, also a bit scary because I had to leave sort of a year of research. Now, of course, these are never lost endeavors. You take a lot of knowledge with you and you're not always sure how it'll be useful, but it always is somehow. But yeah, it was quite scary to change my course.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's the right thing to do, though. It's so compelling. And some of our listeners might not be familiar with Huizinga as an historian. So what can you tell us about his work and his impact on our field?
Right. Well, there are, of course, many ways to introduce Huizinga, but to those entirely unfamiliar with him, I think one helpful way to introduce him would be to say a little about the history of our discipline and then to see where we place him in that landscape. Now, in Europe and definitely also in the Netherlands, the historical discipline has gone through a number of phases. And if we were to oversimplify things tremendously, we could say that there were three or four different phases. We could say that up until, let's say, the Enlightenment, history was a collection of stories about different kinds of peoples, different kings, different farmers, different kinds of parents. And history was a collection of stories about people that would have a pedagogical value to its readers. And we call this phase of history Historia Magistra Vita. So for a long time, history was around to teach us how to be good people, how to be a good king or a good mayor or a good mother, a good father, you name it. So history was a collection of moral examples. Then during the Enlightenment and soon after the Enlightenment, history became what we would now call political history, the history of states, and a history of the lines along which states have developed through time. And political history is still around, but it is not quite as dominant as it once was, because for a long time, political history was the only game to be played at the historical departments. Now, this is oversimplified, obviously, but, well, it's sort of the main caricature. Then, around Huizinga's lifetime, and Huizinga was born 1872, so we could say the second half of the 19th century, things changed at the historical departments in Europe. And a new generation of historians argued that history should not only be a history of the state, but historians should also be invested in the way we dress, the way we sing, the way we kiss, the way we dance, and all these cultural activities that humans engage with. And Huizinga is to be placed in the birth of this third phase, the emergence of cultural history. So that would be one way of introducing him to a very general audience, Jana.
All right. And we call him the father of cultural history.
Yes.
And he suggested an entirely new methodology, a new way of going about seeing the world.
Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. And one complicating factor in this, the title that we give him, sort of the father of cultural history, is that cultural history has come to mean many different things. And all kinds of historical methodologies are called cultural history, but they can vary tremendously. But he is definitely invested in what we would now generally call classical cultural history. Yeah,
right. As opposed to like the new cultural history that you're going to see in the 80s and 90s. But that's probably a little deep in the weeds for people who aren't, you know, we're not...
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, we're not trying to teach you historiography here.
No, we're not. Yeah.
And good and lucky you are, because God, it's definitely inside baseball, as we would say. Yeah. And he's a medievalist, I mean, as well, right? The medievalists claim him as well.
Yeah, no. So that's where he first gained his critical acclaim. His book on the late Middle Ages was written, or he started writing it just before the First World War, and it took him about 10 years to finish it. And then right after the Second World War, it came out. And that is one of the two or three books that he is still to this day most known for. That being said, he quite soon in his career also, well, I wouldn't want to say outgrew, but he dove into different parts of historical research. And the last two-thirds or the last half of his career, he wouldn't necessarily have identified as a medievalist.
Right. So a little bit more, just kind of the nuts and bolts of the book. So you read all of his work, of course. What else do you use as source material?
I read a lot of his personal correspondence letters. And well, maybe we'll get around to discussing those a bit later, but those were very important to me. I was very interested in his personal experiences of a few developments going on in his time. And through his correspondence letters, I tried to pick up which experiences in his personal life resonated with him most strongly, to then see if I could find these resonances in his later professional work as well. So correspondence letters were very important to me, but equally important, I'd say, were newspapers. Read a lot of newspapers. We have a fairly clear understanding of the kinds of newspapers he read. So we have one way of recreating the way he consumed media. And then Huizinga was also deeply interested in art history, but also in his contemporary art. And he befriended all kinds of painters. And also their artistic output has been important to me, because I know it was important to Huizinga. So we have his professional works, his correspondence letters, newspapers, and then, I looked at a lot of art pieces from his times.
Yeah, so you recreated his intellectual world and then placed him in it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And also tried to recreate his more general cultural world. The year that he was born, 1872, is in a way exemplary of how dramatic the transitions were that Europe was going through. Everything was changing in Europe. And 1872 is so symbolic because it is also the year that two modern nations came about, Germany, Italy. And things were moving really very quickly. And that sense of excitement, but also fear at these huge developments belonged to his cultural world. So alongside recreating his intellectual world, I tried to sort of tap into that general cultural sense of unease at all these developments.
Yeah, like there's this zeitgeist of angst, to use our neighbors' terms. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And of course, when things change, you have people who are very excited about the change. And in the change, they see new doors open. For instance, this was the case for many middle-class women in Europe. All these changes were very exciting because, well, they were gaining access to all kinds of new social spaces. And there was a tremendous sense of optimism. But then we also have a group of more grumpy men, and they were not as excited at all about these changes. So for some people, these changes were exciting and positive. And for others, these changes were very, very daunting.
Sure. Yeah. So you start your book with his speech at Leida's 1990 convocation, where he said, "I don't know whether you feel the need for lectures on history, but I need them in order to hold on to history. For a long time, I felt history escape me. Yeah. Despair. How could I teach history? I no longer understand it, and I no longer care for it. The consequence of war? Initially, I also felt that. All the past has lost its importance. What now?" God, which is just, so heavy. Why start here?
Yeah. Well, for a few reasons, but I guess when I first read this lecture, which is indeed the lecture he opened the 1919 academic year with, I immediately tried to imagine what it must have been like for the students sitting there. So we're not quite sure whether these were first, second, or third year students. We don't know. But I'm sure many people sitting in the audience there would have just found their way to the university. And then to find not just an historian, but the most prominent historian, not only of the Netherlands, but of Europe at that point. And to hear him say that he does not understand history and he wonders what the value of history can be when things change as dramatically as they did, and that he is not quite sure how to go about, that must have made such a tremendous impression on the students. So for that reason alone, I found this lecture to be very interesting. But what I find equally interesting is not on the audience's side, but on Huizinga's side. So here is Huizinga taking the stage, and he is displaying a tremendous sense of vulnerability and a tremendous sense of modesty, because he was this critically acclaimed historian, and his authority was based on all his historical knowledge and all his historical training and all his contacts in the world of academic historians. And this historian, whose authority was based on all these on all these accolades, this historian was saying that he was not sure what all his knowledge and all his training could mean in the new world. And it's an incredibly vulnerable thing to say. And that made me realize that these experiences of loss, which is an important term for me in my understanding of Huizinga, that these experiences of loss were enormously strong, not only on him, because many of his peers people in his generation, they express these experiences, but that these experiences of being shaken and unsure and uncertain, that they shook everything. His entire system of belief was shaken. And that made me wonder, well, what did these experiences mean, not only to this particular lecture that he held in 1919, but to all of his historical output since?
Sure, yeah, I mean, this is an epistemological crisis of an epic proportion playing out in front of these kids.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I wish we had some way of finding who was in that audience and to find out if any of the students wrote about this or spoke about this. I would be very interested to know what kind of impression it left on them.
I mean, the jaded history professor in me suggests they were not even paying attention, but...
No, that... Yeah, that's... You're probably right there, Jana, but who knows?
I mean, obviously, not all of them. They must, someone must have been moved by this. This, it does not speak to just historians because it's 1919. Mm-hmm. And these kind of, this feeling of loss and the experience of loss is lived in all of the people who would have been around, the people who set up the chairs, you know, Everybody was experiencing this culture of loss.
Right, right, indeed. And it might be worth mentioning, because I could imagine the listeners tuning in now that they're wondering, well, weren't the Netherlands neutral during the First World War? Why would the Dutch feel so afraid of this war? And why would they have felt so shaken by this war that they never took part in? And that would be a very reasonable question to ask. But the truth is that the Dutch were terrified by this war because Belgium had also started out neutral, and that neutrality didn't help them much. And, well, here is a fact that I find gives a sense of how scary this war was to the Dutch. Because the bombing of Antwerp was so incredibly loud that on a windstill day, you could hear it all the way in Utrecht. And for those who don't know too much about the geography of Belgium and the Netherlands, you are very, very, very forgiven. Utrecht is 200-something kilometers north of Antwerp. So this war was looming over the country. You could literally hear it.
Yeah, that's D.C. and Baltimore for my American listeners, right? That's which are close, but not so close, literally looming. Literally, it's not as if you have to imagine what's happening in Belgium. And this is not a secure border, the Dutch-Belgian border. Like, there's no other, and certainly now we know because the roads get really bad when you cross into Belgium. Yeah. They wouldn't have.
No, right. It was in many ways a paper border, and later on it ended up being, they put a barbed wire. But yeah, what is barbed wire to these machines? Yeah,
certainly. And it's you know, Europe, it didn't, Europe has always been, there's a shared experience of being European, right?
Yeah.
Even which is why developing what culture means and all these questions about, you know, why they matter so much when there is, what's the difference between going from Amsterdam to Paris, right? What do you,
there? No, absolutely. And on top of that, the northern part of Belgium had been part of the Netherlands until the 1830s. So when the war broke out in 1914, well, there might have been some very old Dutchmen who might have been born in an age where northern Belgium and the Netherlands were still one country.
And that language is very similar. I mean, there's just a lot there. I'm getting goosebumps talking about it, so I want to keep hitting this point, but it's probably time to move on. My mistake.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Yeah.
I mean, so Huizenga provides a great case study for this. He lives in this era of epic catastrophe. So for studying the experience of loss, he's great. But tell me about this. We're talking as if the historiography of an experience of loss is the thing that exists. And in some ways, you're trying to do it. So maybe explain this kind of baby of yours.
Yeah, right. Well, I'll start out by zooming out just a little. And that is, I'll start out by saying that we have, in this field of ours, history, we have all kinds of ways of going about studying the past. Sometimes we study books, sometimes we study works of art, sometimes we study diplomatic correspondence, you name it, right? We study all kinds of different things. But the one thing that's a little tricky for us historians to study is the experience of people, because experiences are very ephemeral. They, generally, we could say, right, they're very personal. They live in your mind. And are experiences of a kind that historians can study? Or would that be an arrogant thing to say? Do historians have access to the experiences of people? Now, one way of answering this question would be, well, sure, you could read their diaries, or you could read what they wrote, or, well, whatever kind of source we may have indicating what their experiences are. But it turns out, for all kinds of reasons that I won't get into right now, that it's a bit contested, and many historians don't feel comfortable recreating the experiences of individuals or groups of individuals. And I understand these reasons, and often I agree with them. But I'm a little hesitant to let go of the word experience altogether. So yes, these people that we study in the past, many of them are long gone, and we can't talk to them. And even if we could, we could not creep into their minds and see what their experiences were like. But still, I think that experiences can, in certain cases, be very helpful methodological constructs to recreate what made people do what they did. And now, finally, getting to your question, Jana, because I haven't forgotten about it. There are all kinds of experiences that people can have, but there's this one particular kind of experience, this experience of loss, that I think that we can trace quite neatly in Huizinga's work. So that would be, well, I wouldn't say, well, one of the modest contributions that I try to make. I try to, as it were, make a case for studying experiences, and more in particular, studying this particular kind of experience when it comes to recreating the world of the late 19th century, early 20th century.
All right. So you set up your book with body chapters addressing like a particularly painful loss or a feeling of, I imagine feeling lost as well must have been part of his mindset here. And then, and you examine how this shapes his intellectual critiques. So I think this is probably best understood if we just hop in with, like, let's talk about chapter two, The Tyranny of the Present. Okay, so 1897, Huizinga moves to Harlem to teach. So he's in Harlem, which is 10 kilometers away, right? Is that from Amsterdam?
From Amsterdam, yeah. Something like that.
So what happens?
Right. So at this point, he had just finished his university education, and one of his professors recommended that he'd take up a job as a high school teacher whilst exploring opportunities at the university. So even to this day, that is something that university graduates would consider doing, right? So Huizinga did the same as we would do today, and he went to Harlem and took up this position as a history teacher. But always with his eye on the university, and especially the university in Amsterdam, which was only, as you said, 10 kilometers or maybe even less away. So he spent a lot of time in Amsterdam, and eventually also became what was called a privaatdocent at the University of Amsterdam, which, well, most practically, concretely meant that he taught on a weekly basis, a few students at the University of Amsterdam. And coming from Groningen, which is where he received his training, coming from Groningen to Haarlem and Amsterdam, there he would have seen the tremendous development, the industrial development of Dutch cities, but European cities more generally. Now, Groningen a lot was happening in the Groningen where he grew up. Groningen was not isolated in any way. A lot was happening there, so I wouldn't want to argue that he had been completely shielded off from these modern developments. But in Amsterdam, the developments were of a different degree. And this is where he found a city changing at a huge pace. And even though he hadn't lived there before, he would have seen the construction going on everywhere. And that, I think, was very, very important to him. And you mentioned this second chapter. And in this chapter, I delve into his experiences of these urban development projects in Amsterdam and how they altered his appreciation, not only of what we would now call historical heritage, but also more generally, his appreciation of, let's say, respecting the past in a way. Mm-hmm. It was only when he saw that the past, as symbolized by these old buildings, was discarded so carelessly that he came to believe that the past may need a kind of respect that it seemingly no longer had in the modern world.
Which would be so jarring, and for and really, as an historian, I get this feeling, and this so he responds then. He's got this personal response in the way he's exploring his life, but he this affects his critique in the way he's writing history as well, right?
Yes. No. Exactly. So he has this experience of the past being discarded in Amsterdam. And that's a very personal experience, but indeed it affects also, or maybe primarily, his historical argumentation. Because whilst he's having these experiences, he's reading all kinds of books, but there's one book that he keeps on reading and rereading time again, and that is the book by Burckhardt, a Swiss historian, on the Italian Renaissance. So whilst he's seeing these developments in Amsterdam, he reads Burckhardt. And Burckhardt, for reasons that we'll won't get into right now, but Burckhardt was celebrating the Renaissance mind. And to Burckhardt, the Renaissance mind was so incredibly powerful, so incredibly brave and creative, because this Renaissance mind was prepared to let go of the past, to let go of traditions, and to let go of traditional authorities. And Burckhardt celebrated, in a way, this creative, forward-looking potential of the Renaissance mind. Now, back to Huizinga. Huizinga's reading this book by Burckhardt in a world where people are, well, as the Renaissance was, according to Burckhardt, disposing of the past. But Huizinga wasn't so excited about seeing the past being let go of so easily. And what the point I try to make in this argument is that Huizinga's critique of Burckhardt was in a way fueled by his own experiences of what happens when people let go of tradition. And then Huizinga has all kinds of very academic and technical arguments on why he disagrees with Burckhardt. But sometimes, as humans, we disagree with someone and then we go about looking for reasons why. Now, Huizinga had very good reasons to disagree with Burckhardt, but I think underlying those reasons was a more general, we could say, conservative investment in keeping traditions alive, and that it was important to make a case that creativity was possible in a world where we were not letting go of the past. Yeah, so that would be one way of tying together Huizinga's experiences of his own modern world and why he disagreed with Burckhardt's depiction of Renaissance Italy.
Yeah, and there are many good reasons to disagree with Burckhardt. And
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned this, because I don't want to make it sound that like Huizinga only that he opportunistically went about to find reasons to disagree with Burckhardt. There are good reasons to disagree with him, but my point is mainly that one part of his antipathy towards Burckhardt's depiction came from not necessarily an academic argument, but a lived experience.
Sure. Which, to be clear, we can't pretend historians don't, right? Like,
That's right. We
write history. And
that's right. That's right. And when Antwerp is bombed and shelled, then historians will also hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's going to affect. And I find it interesting his response, this, like, understanding his antipathy to Sarfati and, like, this want and destruction of Old Amsterdam.
Right.
His response to Ypres, which is a theme in chapter 3 in an irretrievably lost past, was, let us accept the catastrophe is irreparable.
Right, right.
So what happens here? What's the difference?
So indeed, we see two different things here. So when Huizinga sees Amsterdam being, in a way, demolished and rebuilt in a modern aesthetic, when he sees that, he starts arguing for a preservation of traditional architecture and traditional ideals. And then, as you rightfully mention, when he sees the destruction of Ypres, the city in Flanders, Belgium, that was entirely destroyed during the Battle of Passchendaele, there his response is different. There, Huizinga, upon seeing the photos of the destruction in Belgium, he says, well, this past can no longer be recreated. Something has gone irretrievably lost here. So this seems to be a very different kind of experience than the one he had in Amsterdam. So in Amsterdam, he says, we need to preserve the past. And then he goes to Belgium, or he sees the photos from Belgium, and he says, well, the past can no longer be retrieved. Now, these experiences seem to be at odds with one another. And not only do they seem to be at odds with one another, they are. And I'll say two things about this. The first is that Huizinga is a human, not only in the sense of being part of a lived world, but he's also human in the sense of that he is not entirely consistent, as none of us are. And he has different voices in him. And upon seeing the photographs from Belgium, something different happens to him, something that didn't happen to him when he walked around Amsterdam. When he sees these photos, he believes that he comes to feel on a very, I'd say, existential level, he comes to feel that the past is actually and continuously being or slips away through the cracks. Every moment that we experience will disappear and end up in a box that you'll never be able to access again. And that is a way of looking at the world that he, as it were, drew from seeing the destruction in Belgium. There he saw here a world had disappeared and it could never be rebuilt again. Now, in that third chapter, the one you mentioned, I try to show how this experience of the Belgian destruction, or the destruction in Belgium, how this influenced his relation not to Burckhardt, but to another historian, Lamprecht, and many historians who were in his corner. And people such as Lamprecht, but I could mention many more, but people such as Lamprecht believed that history, or historians rather, had the, let's say, moral academic obligation to recreate the past and to collect all kinds of facts from the past. Now, Huizinga had lost the belief that history should be the reconstruction of facts. Huizinga believed that, in a way, history is irretrievably lost. And, well, to make things overly simple, but without ending up in a long, long monologue, Huizinga started believing that historians, their principal job was not only spelling out the facts of the past, but creating certain virtues in the readers of historical books and in historians themselves, and believe that history should prepare its readers for the losses that they find in their own world. And in that way, I think we see that his the impressions that these photos of Belgium made on him meant that history had to be a way of dealing with these sites of destruction.
And the world, Europe in particular, is a very different place in 1919 than it was in 1897, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, no, absolutely. And so we have huge developments when it comes to the way that we build our cities and structure our landscapes and the way we organize our societies and the role of the worker and the woman, and everything is moving, everything is developing. So yes, between 1897 and 1919, many things have changed, structural transitions. But something that is also very important to understanding Huizinga is that during the First World War, he's seeing not only the destruction of Belgium, but also the destruction of the life of his wife, who dies very young. And together they have five children, and they had what seems from, well, all sources I found, they had a very, very loving relationship. Not only Huizinga and his wife, but the entire family. And the loss of his wife during the First World War, I think, in a way, heightened his grief at seeing the pictures of Belgium. He saw not only the destruction of a world that he had studied and grown up in, but it was laced with the feeling that, well, of his feelings of mourning his wife, which I think made the outside world also very personal to him. We have this mourning feeling of the world and his wife being laced with one another.
Sure. And the entire world is in a crisis in 1919. Of Europe is in a crisis in 1919. The Western world, I mean, this is the lost generation, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. Many, many, many things can be said about this, and in the book, I start by citing a passage from a French historian, and this historian writes that during the First World War, for the first time, Europe has the opportunity to feel what it means to be a lost civilization, the kind of civilizations that European anthropologists only found in deserts.
Yeah, yeah. On a slightly lighter note, as I read The Future Machine, Chapter 4, I began to wonder how much of what Europeans' ideas about the U.S. have to do with us, Americans, which, you know, and how many of these belong to Huizinga?
Yeah, so Huizinga travels to the U.S. after the First World War, and he sees this modern world, this mechanized world, that's what he calls it, and he comes to reappreciate Europe in the light of all the things that America, according to him, is not. And, well, we've been talking about 1919, and I'll just quickly return to that year, because the end of the First World War also means the introduction of American culture in Europe. American troops come to Europe. Many of them stick around. They bring all kinds of new music and new nightlife to European cities. And the American imprint is very palpable. So when Huizinga travels to the US, he feels that he's not only visiting another country, but he is, as it were, visiting Europe's future. He's coming to see what Europe will be like in a few decades' time, because more and more Americans are coming to Europe. So traveling to the US is also to him traveling into the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you get this vision of him as this personally deeply conservative person.
Yeah.
How is that appropriate?
Yeah, that's That's an excellent question, and I'm very glad you ask it, because up until now, I've also called him conservative a few times, and generally, I think it's fine to call him conservative, but then we still need to pause for a minute and rethink what we mean by conservative. Conservative is actually a rather complicated term because it changes meaning. Being conservative in 2024 is something very different from being conservative in 1924. For instance, conservatives in 1924, such as Huizinga, argued for internationalism, for humanism, for pacifism. They were trying to conserve the ideals of this old aristocratic world. And those ideals, conservative ideals, are very, very different from the ideals that we would call conservative today. So we need to be very careful when we use this word. Yes, Huizinga was conservative and wanted to conserve the ideals of his youth, but those ideals are very different from conservative ideals today.
Yeah, of course. And his conservatism certainly, I mean, as discussed, comes from a good place. So we were talking, before we started recording, audience, we were talking a bit about COVID, but beyond that, right, it feels right now as if we are living in this unprecedented time, this era of change so significant that it provides a catastrophic, unimpeachable break with the past, right?
Right.
I mean, would you agree with that? But this feels...
Yeah. No, absolutely. Many things could be said about this. I think in Europe, we have this feeling, and then at the same time in Europe, we also feel like we're being thrown back into the past now that we have all kinds of trench warfare on our eastern border. But yeah, we have the feeling that things are being lost. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, and if we think about the stuff we're writing our sci-fi about right now, it's about AI and plagues. And,
right.
Everyone was reading Camus again a couple years ago. I don't know what to do with that. But I'm just... Does everyone always think that? Right?
Yeah.
I know my Renaissance historians thought that they were dealing with an unimpeachable break with the past, and then Burckhardt makes that seem realer. But
yeah. Well, I think that these feelings and sentiments exist always and in a way continuously. But they might not always and continuously exist among all social groups. I think sometimes a few social groups might have this feeling, and then many social groups may have the feeling that things are being just fine, depending on whether they're, well, let's say, white or male or whatever. So this feeling of catastrophe can, of course, depend on the social group you belong to. But then every now and then, these experiences of catastrophe take a hold of many groups at a time. And I think that is very true for us today, in my amateur opinion, because now I'm leaving, of course, my expertise.
Yeah, no, we're not. I'm just speaking as historians in the way.
Right, kind of, yeah.
You know, the way we write history... you know, as if there are periods and there are breaks. I suppose as historians, we're pretty deeply invested in the idea that there are massive changes, right?
Yeah. No, like, absolutely, yeah. No.
I can feel this sort of thing. You know, there's an age at which, you know, with, at 40, I think that was the quote I read in your book, at 40, where you realize that your future is not everyone's future anymore.
Yeah.
So yeah. There's this personal feeling of loss that I see here that I understand, and I'm trying to just make some connections with how I feel like the world is feeling right now.
Yeah. No, yeah. The quote you mentioned or the citation comes from Thomas Mann, and I think it's very interesting in this regard. Now, we started off our conversation discussing the huge transitions in the late 19th century and how these transitions sparked optimism among certain groups and pessimism among other groups. And the question on which side of that border one falls, well, oftentimes will have something to do with age. Thomas Mann mentioned at the age of 42, if I'm not mistaken, that he felt that the future was no longer his. In a way, he had now, he was a spectator. This was a young person's game. What is interesting in this regard, that was actually the point that I wanted to make, is that now we see a lot of conservatism, at least in the Netherlands, and I think in Europe, it's a Europe-wide phenomenon, but we see conservatism among young people. And that is something that is a little different from the late 19th century. So there we saw a lot of conservatism, but as the citation from Mann sort of exemplifies, among the elderly. But then now today, it's among a lot of the young people and a lot of the voters. And this is pertaining to a very Dutch context, so apologies to the listeners who are not as interested as I am in this. But the voters in the Netherlands voting for the most extreme right-wing parties are often very young.
Yeah, which is not how it's supposed to go, right? That's not the pattern.
No, that is not the pattern. And therefore also, frightening, but also very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, both of those things. Yeah, but I think everyone feels that they're living in unprecedented times always. And I think part of the human condition might just be fear about that.
No, I think that's a very good observation. And I would subscribe to that entirely. Returning to Huizinga, I think on one hand, that would invite us to ask, well, what could we learn from Huizinga today? So Huizinga experienced all these dramatic transitions. We are also experiencing dramatic transitions. Can Huizinga help us to decide on how to go about A, B, or C? Or whatever, you know, you fill in the question you want to see answered. And I thought a lot about this, obviously, writing this book about Huizinga, always wondering why on earth would I be writing a book about Huizinga? In what way could we make him urgent or relevant or important to us today? And I considered all kinds of answers, and I thought, well, maybe Huizinga can tell us about how we can create new political narratives that might sway people from the extreme side of the spectrum back to the center, or blah, blah, blah. So I thought about what are the different ways we could make Huizinga relevant. And I landed on making a point that I hadn't planned to make at the outset of my, well, definitely not my PhD research, but also writing the book on Huizinga. And I think that what I find most urgent in Huizinga for us today is that Huizinga makes us or made his students comfortable with modesty. And what I mean about this with this is the following. And let's remember here this lecture that we discussed by him from 1919, where he said, "I don't know what's going on. I don't know what the value of all our historical knowledge is now that things are changing so dramatically." And that modesty, that vulnerability that he displayed on the stage there, giving this lecture, that is a kind of modesty and vulnerability that I think is not only, well, beautiful, but also something that might be of huge practical value. When things are uncertain and when we don't know which way to look and when we feel this complete corrosive unease, that feeling very easily sort of pushes us to embrace new truths with a capital T and to find new explanations so that we immediately get rid of this feeling of being uncertain by finding new idols. Oh, yeah. So I was wrong, but now this is the truth. Now I've figured everything out again. I can reduce everything to this one logic. I've got things figured out. I felt uneasy, but now I can rest assured I know how this world works again. And Huizinga taught his students, and I think still teaches his readers today, that you can feel uneasy and uncertain and realize that there's a lot you don't know, and then try to feel comfort or feel comfortable in that feeling. And that is something that that is a lesson I find in Huizinga that I think is very urgent and very important today. And I'll end by, or end this answer with, well, let's call it just an anecdote. And that is, so I teach at the University of Utrecht, and I meet a lot of students who have a lot of questions, but I also meet a lot of students who think they've got this world figured out already. They know it all. And I have, in that light, really come to appreciate students when they don't know the answer to a question, when they say, "I don't know." And it's very scary to say this as a student to your teacher, to admit that you don't know something, because you expect that your teacher wants to hear from you that you know. But I have a deep sympathy often for students, I mean, depending on the reasons why they don't know, but often a deep sympathy for students who say that they don't know, because to me that signals that they take seriously the word knowing. They don't use it lightly. It is very, very hard to know something. It is very hard to really understand something. And, well, these words should sort of instill a certain respect among us, and we shouldn't use them too lightly. And that is an ideal that I find in Huizinga's works.
Wow, that's a great place to like wrap up our conversation. Because I mean, this last bit was a bit unfair. I asked you to be a philosopher as well. Mm-hmm. But I got to tell you, that's one of the things that I loved about this book, is how much I can see this as a book that's going to change, that is changing the way I'm thinking. And there are a few books that really do that. I can list a few, you know, in the course of my life I've read that really made me kind of reconsider. I also fell in love with Huizinga in this way that I had not expected.
Thank you. That's wonderful to hear.
Yeah. It's a really, it's a delight as a book, as an historian. It's a delight, as a book, as someone who's interested in the Netherlands, but it's also it's the kind of book that can be very instructive for everyone who's interested in writing history and understanding how we do it. I think it's great. I think it should be required reading. Which I do not say lightly. But the good news is it's open access, so everyone can.
Yeah, no, well, first of all, thank you, Jana, for these words. That's very humbling. Thank you. And yes, the book is open access. I'm very happy about that. I needed some time to get the funding to have it open access, but I'm very happy that we managed to get this in the end. Yeah.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I mean this, everyone should read it. And I have a few people I'm going to bully into reading it immediately. So congratulations. I don't know what I mean for that. I've taken up so much of your time, but just two more minutes. What are you working on now? What's next?
Yeah, I am now working on what is going to become a book, or at least this is the plan, which will deal very... or deal with a more general topic, namely with cultural history of the 1920s in Central and Western Europe. And this time I'm going to try to explore a few experiences of loss, not of just Huizinga, but in Europe more generally. So I'm going to zoom out a bit and try to give... a more comprehensive look on Europe in this decade.
What decade? I missed it.
Oh, the 1920s. Excuse me.
The 1920s. Yeah. Okay, brilliant. Yeah, yeah. No, that, sure you said it. Yeah. I just was thinking, you know, because something we didn't get to how the rest of the story with, and we're not going to take the time, but you know, World War II happens as well, and
yeah,
at a very personal cost.
Yeah, yeah. No, right. And as you say, we won't delve into that right now, but it might be still worthwhile mentioning that, yes, Huizinga died in 45, but before the Netherlands were liberated. So in a way, the Second World War to Huizinga took an eternity. He never got to see it end. So this sense of loss was also a sense that up until the very end dominated his life.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question the Nazi questioning and being banned brought about the end of his life, right?
That's Yeah.
You don't come back from being questioned by the Nazis and
No, you don't.
Yeah. All right. So, we almost ended on a bright note, but
sorry about that.
Nah, we're talking about Europe in the 20th century. That's not really in the cards. So thanks very much. And I'm looking forward to reading the next book, and we'll talk after that.
Thank you so much, Jana. Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Excellent. Have a great day. Ciao.